Hi, and welcome to episode 261 of the Untethered podcast. This is your host, Hallie Balkin, and today we have Ken Hooks joining us. Ken is the founder and operator of True Sleep Diagnostics based in Greenville, South Carolina. He offers home sleep tests for providers and via mail order. He's a registered respiratory therapist with 12 years of experience and a registered polysomnographic technologist for adults and pediatrics with 11 years of experience. He's the former sleep medicine representative for Bonsecure St. Francis in Greenville, South Carolina, and the former clinical director and instructor of the polysomnographic technician course at Greenville Technical College. He co-authored the case report, Rapid Maxillary Expansion, an Adenotonsillectomy in 9-year-old twins with pediatric obstructive sleep apnea syndrome, an interdisciplinary effort. Quick disclaimer, all information, content, and material of this podcast are the opinions of the speakers and is for the informational purpose only and not intended to serve as a substitute for the consultation, diagnosis, and/or medical treatment of a qualified healthcare provider. Welcome to the Untethered Podcast. I am your host, Hallie Balkin. I'm a certified myofunctional therapist, feeding specialist, podcaster, business owner, and mentor. This podcast is all about getting your questions answered and collaborating with colleagues to bring you the most up-to-date information in the orofacial myofunctional therapy, airway, tethered oral tissue, and pediatric feeding therapy space. If you're new here, I challenge you to keep an open mind and join my mission to spread this message far and wide. If you've been around since June 2019, thanks for being a loyal listener. As we jump into today's episode, remember to listen with correct oral rest posture. Tongue up, lips closed, teeth apart, breathe through your nose. Let's get started. Ken, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I'm excited to have you. It's kind of a treat for me because I know the last time we recorded, we were reviewing my sleep results from a couple of years ago, right? Was that the last time we recorded?
That was, yeah.
Times. Okay.
2022 maybe.
Yeah. So it's been a couple of years. It was right before I had my nose surgery. So I had a septoplasty, a nasal, or I had a turbinate reduction. I had a nasal swell body reduction. And then I also had a rhinoplasty because I was like, we're under, why not? So yay. So now it's been 2 years. I do feel like I can breathe a lot better. And I know that my results were not perfect, but that there's improvement. So for anybody listening who's like, I want to see what you're talking about, you're going to probably want to watch this episode on YouTube because we are screen sharing my home sleep test report that Ken sent over. But Ken, I want to turn it over to you so you can kind of like tell everybody, like maybe even just start with, for anybody who hasn't listened to the other episode, like what you do with home sleep testing and your business and True Sleep Diagnostics, and like even what you send out to people, the device, why that's maybe different. Cause sometimes people hear home sleep tests and they go, well, that's not that valid. And I know you do it differently than others and it gets really good results. So I want to let you kind of speak to that first.
Okay. So I'm going to try to stay on track because I get upset talking about that. As the young folks say, I'm triggered. So the home sleep test is just a modified or scaled down version of an in-lab sleep test. The nasal cannula is the same. Pulse oximetry is the same. Even the effort belt is the same. The things that are different are there's no leg leads. So like periodic limb movements that can't be monitored. There's no EEG, all the leads on your head. On the sleep studies that I have, the sleep stages is interpolated and it's around 85% correctness. The belt in the lab, you'll have two instead of one, and then you'll have EKG. In your nose, you'll have two types of monitors. You'll have the nasal cannula, which is the pressure transducer. That's how we see the airflow dynamics. And then you'll have a thermistor that monitors temperature, and that we use that to pick up apneas. So it's like a backup. So there's no difference. The same thing that you're using in the lab, you're using on a home sleep test as far as for assessing airflow and apneas and hypopneas. The pressure transducer, I really love because you can't see the dynamics. The device I use, the Alice Knight 1 by Respironics. Some labs do use that, and it's I just like it because I'm used to it. I was used to that software. I've used that software out of the three or four that I've used. I've used that one the longest, and so it just was a little bit easier for me to use that. And I have my channels and everything already set up. And what I mean by that is like the SpO2 pleth or the plethysmography. I do use that to kind of see how, if the airflow limitation is important or not. The pleth waveform, every waveform is actually a heartbeat, and the amount of waveforms you have in like 30 seconds, we can see the heartbeat. But at the same time, if there's something going on with the pleth, if the amplitude reduces, that's a reduced amount of blood flow going to the periphery. And so typically when you see some upper airway resistance or airflow limitation, just behind that, you'll see the body react, the pleth react. And since the volume is reducing, we'll also see the heart rate react. And, you know, I say this sometimes, I always believe that the pulse or the heart is the most important thing on a sleep study, because if your body needs oxygen, the heart's going to pump 1,000 times a minute to get it what it needs. In times of trouble, everything is shunted to the things that matter most to the body, the heart and the lungs. Everything else is kind of cut off. And so the body is screaming and starving, and the heart wills, I can give you as much as you want. I'll just pump a little bit faster. So we don't necessarily see oxygen desaturations on patients with upper airway resistance. And even in the sleep scoring manual for apneas, there doesn't have to be an accompanying desaturation. So with the study, I'm doing everything by hand. I don't automate the home sleep testing. The only thing that's automated is the sleep staging. But as far as tabulating the apneas and hypopneas and talking about the dynamics of the airflow, those are things that I'm actually looking at on the study. So I'll go through the whole thing and assess it. And the hypnogram, if you don't know me, if you've never heard me say anything before, the hypnogram to me is the most important thing for patients to be able to see, because it's tangible evidence of what's really going on throughout the night. And you can see how your pulse rate is spiking in areas where you may have trouble. And some patients will say, well, I don't see any respiratory events where my pulse is spiking. I'm like, yeah, well, that is the upper airway resistance area right there that we can't actually put on here. But these are the things that I'm talking about. And that shows the importance of the actual pulse on a study versus oxygen saturation.
Thank you. I know that it's I'm so glad that I triggered you, because it's always a fun part of an episode.
It's almost like the very first podcast, I don't know if you remember this, but it was after talking to a pediatric sleep doctor, and I was so mad, but I was on fire.
That's good, right? Because that just brings out the best side of you. You're like, educate people here. And I think it's so interesting, because that's that rhetoric is like, oh, well, if it's at home and it's not in a lab, then it's not as, you know, it's not as good of a study, or it's not as accurate, it's not as valid. And, you know, what I've learned from you and some others is that actually it is. And it's really about the interpretation of the data too on the back end. And so I love that, you know, you do a lot of this manually and you're able to kind of pull together a whole picture, which is why I was like, all right, Ken, we're doing this before, we're going to do this after. And, you know, it took me a good solid year or so to heal, because I had the rhinoplasty and there was swelling and inflammation and everything. And then so finally I was like, oh my gosh, okay, it's been like 2 years now. Like, let's do this thing. I went for like my 2-year follow-up with the ENT, and I was like, Ken, we got to record. We got to do another sleep study. And you like sent me the thing, and here we are. So yeah, I want to dive into, and you tell me where you want me to scroll to on here. Do you want me to start up top?
So yeah, we can start up top. And okay. So I'm actually looking at, on my other screen over here, I'm looking at your old study too. Okay. So we can kind of make comparisons. So there's subtleties to sleep and sleep reporting that we don't necessarily take into consideration or look at. And sleep being very, very subjective is something that we really have to take into consideration, the whole thing. And I know I talk junk about numbers, but at the same time, numbers can shed light on improvement. And so when we look at the numbers up here, the time and duration, you almost minute for minute, the total sleep time on this study, this newest one, is 422 minutes. Mm-hmm. Your previous one was 448 minutes. So we're really close to the same amount of time. Your sleep efficiency on the previous one was 90%. This one is 96.2. Now, this can be a little bit overestimated, because we don't have true EEG, so there's no arousals. The previous one, I can tell you that there were a bunch of arousals and fragmentation throughout the whole study. So the increase in sleep efficiency is better. the wake after sleep onset is reduced. The previous one was 24.5. This is 14.5. So we're seeing an increase in sleep consolidation. We'll be able to see that on the hypnogram too. The HI 0.1, I'm going to tell you, I mean, out of all my patients, and I do a lot of kids, the AHIs, if I see someone with high or moderate or severe, I mean, it may be like 1%. So the majority of my patients do not have clinical sleep apnea. It's very mild. So for me to see a 0.1, I would say, I mean, I don't necessarily care about that anyway, because I need to look at the airflow. I need to look at the dynamics to see how the body is reacting to what's going on. So in comparison, though, the HI on the last one was 0.7. So we still see a reduction in significant events as well, where the previous study, the total was 5 significant events, and there was one here. As we scroll down to the next page. Okay, so interestingly, one thing that I can't remember if I've ever taught this before, but when you increase nasal efficiency, there's a potential to also increase oxygen saturation, because the turbinates, excuse me, provide back pressure to keep the alveoli and the lungs open, allowing you to have better oxygenation. So average oxygenation on the last one, 95%, average on this one, 96%. Is that a huge difference? It's bigger than you probably think, because the heart is working less to provide this with the nasal flow being better. The lowest on this one is 93%. The lowest on the previous was 91%. So we're still doing everything better on this study. The heart rate on this one, the average picked up by the machine was 55.3. The previous one was 57. The highest heart rate was 84. This one is 73. So we are seeing increases in sleep consolidation and physiological changes as well. More of I can't even think of a word, like the body's better. The body's getting better. I'll say it that way. When we look at the sleep staging that's interpolated by the machine, you had 14% deep sleep last time. You had 17.7 this time. The ranges, which is kind of controversial for deep sleep, is 13 to 20%. I kind of like closer to 20%. And the deep sleep is a testament to the body's ability to feel safe. If upper airway resistance or significant events are occurring throughout the night, the body is either not going to go into deep sleep, or it's going to go, just not for a long time. In deep sleep, we're completely disengaged from our surroundings. We can't feel and we can't hear. And with us still being animals as mammals, we do have instincts of trying to, for survival. And if the body's like, well, I mean, we're on edge all the time. We're under a threat all the time. We can't necessarily go to sleep, because what if you don't come out? So we do see an increase in deep sleep here, which is really good. Also, we see a slight increase in REM sleep. So REM sleep, we'll max out REM sleep at 25%. Usually anything over that will signal some sort of maybe sleep deprivation or increased stress, physiological or mental. The previous study, that was 22.3%. So we also see an increase in REM sleep. The hypnogram below here is like a quick snapshot, but we'll go to the next page for a bigger one. So here we can see that let's go through the channel. So this top snore channel here is the machine actually picking up the snoring. On a home sleep test, the snoring is picked up through the nasal cannula, increased airflow turbulence. In a lab, there's a vibration monitor we'll put over the vocal cords to pick up the snoring. It's called a microphone, but it's not a microphone. The thing that I like about this coming through the nasal cannula is, even if there's no snoring, we can still quantify or look at heavy or harsh breathing where there's increased resistance in that tube. So some of these, and you can't see them here, but they're small blips. And the bigger the blip, sometimes they're huge, the louder the snore is. For that patient. The next line down is the heart rate or pulse rate. That's the green line. And this line, for the most part, should be fairly straight throughout the study. And in comparison from the last one, this one, even this is improved. There was some chaos on the last one. Even just to say this again, even with an AHI of 0.7, the pulse was still chaotic. And if the pulse is chaotic and the patient has signs and symptoms, then we do have a problem. Apneas and hypopneas don't tell that story. So on the heart, we have the heart rate here is the second channel. The channel below that, the blue channel, is the oxygen saturation. Haley is fit and athletic, so her heart rate's lower, so they're kind of coming together. One thing that we could tell about a patient, too, is potentially how well their heart is operating. If this is very chaotic, or we see extreme peaks and valleys, you kind of see where it's like fuzzy in areas. Those fuzzy areas are fluctuations. Besides the times where we see really big vaults, usually that's during a body movement, we'll see them that big. But for patients that do not necessarily have great heart function, we will see a lot of spikes and we'll see a lot of fuzzies as the body is trying to keep you alive. The next channel down, that snore actually is me going through the study and highlighting all these blips. The machine will do this automatically, but if I see there's areas where there's actually no snoring, then I'll take out the whole chain and I'll go back through and actually do the snoring to make it more realistic and true to what it is for the patient. The next line down, the respiratory events, these are significant events. Apneas and hypopneas will show up here. Again, this does not necessarily tell the tale for a patient. It would be the pulse that would be the most important thing to look at on the hypnogram. Unless, of course, you have severe sleep apnea and there's just tick marks like scattered all throughout there. The next line down is the body position. The body position is important. Sometimes patients will say, well, they told me to do like two or three nights. The difference between nights for a patient on a sleep study will be A, heavy drinking, B, narcotics or medicine changes, stressful days, or sleep deprivation. If you think about it, and the other thing is to make sure that you got a good study. Some providers will do multiple nights to say, okay, this was the best night, it's good. There's no difference in if you go to a sleep lab, they're not going to say, yeah, we need you to be here for like three or four nights. But there's this misconception that you have to do multiple nights on the HST because things may change. So I've done multiple 3 to 5 night studies. And I mean, honestly and truly, there may be very small changes in between them. All the nights are so close together, with the only difference being body change, body position change. If you sleep on your left side all night and everything is looking decent, and then you sleep on your back one night and just like all hell breaks loose, of course, those nights will be different. So for patients, it is really, I know this is another thing in sleep where everybody says sleep on your back because that's where you're worst and we want to fix you at your worst. How do you sleep naturally is really what we need to be seeing, because if you sleep on your left side naturally and you have a partner, a bed partner that says, yeah, they do sleep on this side, that is what we want to assess. We want to assess the problem there, because with upper air resistance, facial architecture can play a role. If we have, you know, the tongue pressures are not the same on either side, then sleeping on one side may be better for the other. There may be more nasal congestion on one side than the other, based off of the way the palate is shaped because of that. So body position is there. The next line down or the next channel down are the actual sleep stages. The highest line is wake. The next line down that has the salmon colored tops, that's REM sleep. The blue lines are light sleep, which would be stages 1 and 2. And then deep sleep is the green. That would be stage 3 or 3 and 4. Here we could see a breakdown or tangible evidence of sleep stages. In a perfect world, in the most perfect world of unicorns and ponies, our sleep would roll in 90-minute increments. You go to sleep, you go into deep sleep, you come back up in a light sleep, and then you go to REM sleep. REM is a very light stage of sleep. And then you go back down. You start off with a bunch of deep sleep, a little bit of REM sleep. As the night goes on, you get more REM sleep and you get less deep sleep. This is a process the body goes through for a couple of things, or for multiple things. But in deep sleep, it almost is the, like, it's the house cleaner. It's doing everything. It's cleaning the body. You're getting oxygen to muscles and tissues, inflammation is being reduced, but it also is starting to take these thoughts and memories and ideas and it's spreading them out. It's categorizing them. In deep sleep, we also get rid of protein plaque in the brain through cerebral spinal fluid. If you are having arousals and upper airway resistance and respiratory events, norepinephrine will fill that space. So you can't get rid of that protein plaque through cerebral spinal. It's only one channel. Then when you're going into REM sleep, all these things that are starting to be categorized, it's going to be locked away. So REM sleep is all about cognition. It's also when we depotentiate the amygdala or wash the amygdala away. So the amygdala is part of our fear-based system, and it's where we kind of hold on to traumas and all the things that shape us into who we are. And when we wash that away, today's troubles are not tomorrow's troubles. They're memories of today or memories of yesterday. But if we don't wash this amygdala, if that process is broken, we can have anxiety and trauma. We become more carnal and aggressive in nature. The synapses, we don't produce or maintain as many synapses. It looks like the brain of a patient that does have some pretty good PTSD. So short-term memory loss comes from there. Early morning headaches, anxieties, aggression, or testiness when you wake up and you love grits and somebody says you want grits and you're like, I don't give a crap about no grits. That it could be that you did not necessarily sleep that well. You didn't get good REM sleep. In those two stages, not only can you dream in REM, but you can dream in deep sleep as well. So for kids, the kids that have night terrors will be in deep sleep. You can't get through to them. They can't see you. They can't hear you because they're still in deep sleep. It's just that deep sleep has been broken. So they're there and they are still in the midst of that dream. And then they fall back out and they don't remember anything. So that's a night terror. And then in REM sleep, we have the nightmares where you wake up and you go, that was crazy. That kind of thing. So this would be this hypnogram here would be the place that I would go with a patient and say, okay, so let's look at how your pulse is doing over the whole night. For patients with upper airway resistance, we are going to typically see severe respiratory events in REM sleep. I have been doing research for the last 2 months on why the upper airway tone just is completely done for in REM sleep. Everything is paralyzed except for the diaphragm. But this has been a topic of discussion for 40 years since REM has been actually found. Not necessarily why there's no upper airway tone, but how. What are the mechanisms of the upper airway tone that they are just completely gone if we do need stability of the upper airway? Of course, we're not supposed to be talking and stuff like that. So phonation should not be going on or happening. But you see here, every time that we see a spot of REM sleep, if we look up to the pulse rate, we can see how the pulse is the craziest it is throughout the whole night. We got a lot of fluctuations. Breathing also does change during REM sleep. It's very erratic and is different because so when we go to sleep, we have a little bit of reduction of volume. And for us to breathe, our bodies want to ventilate a certain amount of volume per minute. Each breath is the volume. Our respiratory rate makes up that other side. So if your volume reduces, you're going to breathe faster. If your volume increases, you're going to breathe slower. When you hit REM sleep and everything's paralyzed, the diaphragm's the only thing that's going, it just is going to do what it's going to do. So at the beginning, you may breathe really fast and you'll see these short breaths a bunch of times. And then you may start breathing a little bit bigger and everything will slow down. It's very erratic. And you can also tell in the upper airway tone how just sporadic the amount of tone increases and reduces over this time. So the airflow, instead of being a sinus wave, will sometimes be very jagged. You can look at airflow and say, this person probably is in REM. Very jagged, erratic type breathing. So we aren't necessarily set up for success in REM sleep. If you do not have really, really good muscle tone in the upper airway, it will really show up during REM sleep. then as you can see here, you don't have very many significant respiratory events in REM sleep, but there still is something that is going on. You still are having where your pulse rate is fluctuating throughout this whole experience of the REM sleep. I know this sounds crazy, but it's important because we want you to have consolidated REM, right? We want that process not to be broken. So that you won't be a broken human, you know?
So, that is the goal, yeah.
That's the goal.
That is the goal.
So, when we look at this study versus the previous study, this study is calmer. The pulse rate is definitely calmer. There's no body position switching. We will switch body positions as we transition into lighter sleep, and also as we're aroused, the body will switch body positions to try to break the airway open if necessary. And in addition, there were a lot more periods of wake, instances of wake. And so I hate to go on assumptions, but just looking at the hypnogram, every time that you see a period of wake, we can say this is a period of arousal. Now, this is going to be scaled down here because the machine does not pick up EEG. There is a case study that was done with 300 or 400 patients where the physicians were looking at pulse rate activity in conjunction with arousals to say, okay, we can probably tell an arousal based off a pulse rate spike, but what would that be? So when the pulse rate rises greater than 3 beats per minute and continually goes up, that is a point where there would be an arousal. And so I take that into consideration on a home sleep test to say, okay, this underestimates when I say on the sleep study, the AHI underestimates, and there are times when I don't, it's rare, but I'll say it underestimates because truly there is a problem greater than what apneas or hypopneas will say. The things that insurance says are significant. There truly is more going on to it than that. So I thought the last study was decent. And then I look at this one and I'm like, and I look at the old one and I'm like, no, it's not.
No. Well, you know what else, Ken? I don't know if I told you, but my dog ended up having to have like surgery that day. And I already had the study and I was like, well, I'm not going to delay this because the dog's going to be healing for like 2 weeks. So I was like, we're just going to do it. But he was like sleeping against me. And I went to sleep and he had stitches. He came out. I thought he was going to have sutures like in one place. And they called me. They're like, well, he's got some other growths or like right on the side. I thought they meant like on the side of the location they were already operating on. So they're like, can we just, you know, treat that too? I'm like, yeah. I mean, he's already under, like, just do what you got to do. The dog comes home and looking like Frankenstein. Like he has five different suture areas and they're on the side of his body. So it was like left side, right side, top, back.
Oh my God.
I'm looking at the dog and I'm like, how am I going to sleep next to him tonight? Cause he sleeps in our bed. So there's that. But I remember he did wake me up at one point. So one of these arousals was him physically waking me up, not because of any other reason, but okay. I don't recall him waking me up other times. So I actually have to wonder too, if my sleep is somewhat better, especially later in the night. That's when he woke me up. I don't remember if it was 3 a.m., 4 a.m., or what time it was, but it was definitely one of these arousals where he woke me up and I was like, dang it. I was like, but we made it really far. I looked at the time and I was like, oh, yep, okay. And I did go, I feel like I went right back to sleep. At least I thought, you know, felt like I went back to sleep. But I was like looking at the patterns too, because I think last time one of the things was the second I went into REM, I feel like I popped out of REM was a pattern. And then here it seems like when I had some, you know, in the beginning, the patterns of going into deep sleep, it's like, okay, not too bad. We seem to be in a cycle here. And then all of a sudden it's like, and we stopped going into deep sleep around 12:30 or 1 a.m. I should have gone into deep sleep around then. And I went into a very short period of deep sleep before I was woken. Yes. Yeah. So anyway, so I thought that was interesting. I don't recall him waking me up, but it's possible. But I definitely feel more rested now. I feel like sometimes if my nose is a little bit more congested, I feel like my sleep, I don't feel as tired the next day. So there's definitely an improvement in symptoms, but you know, there's also inflammation still in the body at times, that I feel like improved a lot after the nasal surgery and is it kind of waxes and wanes now. So, you know, and as I'm listening to you talk, I'm like, oh yeah. I mean, you forget that even though I might feel more rested now when I wake up than I used to, you know, 2+ years ago,
yeah,
a lot of the inflammation of the body could be just that my body's not getting into that deep sleep mode all the time or as frequently as it should in the middle of the night.
Yeah. And it's, it, you know, the body loves itself so much that it will kill itself to try to make everything work, you know? And that part of sleep is rough because cortisol, you know, we release cortisol to reduce inflammation and stress and things like that. But if cortisol is out for too long, it's going to cause stress. It's going to cause trouble and problems. And so this one thing to think about when we see like a short period of deep sleep or no deep sleep, where we do not necessarily have a period where the body can be without inflammation. And I'm going to say fibromyalgia. I'm not going to directly link it, but for patients that do have fibromyalgia or some type of peripheral pain or joint pain or things like that, unexplained or idiopathic, I mean, they potentially have zero deep sleep or very low deep sleep, where just the cortisol is taking over because the body just is so wrecked and whacked out that it honestly is just now in a struggle. And that is a lot of patients with upper airway resistance, being that they're consistently and constantly in a period where the body's like, I wish you would stop not getting the volume you need over and over. And it's like, I'm going to make you gasp and you gasp and then everything's normal for like 2 seconds and then you get it again. Mm. And that goes on throughout the night and you never have an apnea or you never have an hypopnea, but the body is having the same reaction to those things.
Yeah.
So that's the tangibility of the hypnogram, being able to see what's going on.
Yeah.
And so on this technician notes and interpretation, this is me talking about what I see on the sleep study. And I have no bias because whether you get treated or not, like I have nothing to do with that. I just really want to tell you what I see objectively and what's going on. And two, when patients do two studies, I try not to have bias then too, because sometimes the second study is not better or not great, you know? And so, here's where I'll talk about the things that are going on, and the things that I'll see. And so here I did say, there was some mildly intense flow limited breaths that went along with the breathing. So this would be a point, and the providers that I work with do a really good job of assessing patients and the symptoms. Because if I say this, even though I say this appropriately estimates, there still is some mildly intense flow limitation. And that still can cause some trouble. And so if you're talking to a patient or you're a patient talking to your provider and you still express certain things that are going on, it needs to be taken into consideration that we still are having some stuff going on. Very mild snoring through the study. Sometimes I'll say, you know, it may not be audible. The snoring may not be audible based on how small the intensity was. Doesn't necessarily mean that it is inaudible. Snoring is another thing where, I don't know if you ever tried this, but when the teeth are together, the tongue is the furthest away from the back of the throat. And it is hard to snore unless you have chin recession. It is really hard to snore. It's so much easier to snore with your mouth open because when the teeth are apart, the tongue is closer to the back of the throat. There's all that soft tissue is back there and you're decreasing the space and then you cause an airway fart. I'm coining that. So
I love it. My kids are going to run with that one.
So the snoring, if I do see moderate, sometimes mild, I'll say there's potential or high potential for some open mouth or open teeth breathing. That's important to note because if we do have some open teeth breathing, the body is not secure enough with the nasal flow. If the nasal flow was great and perfect, there would be no need for the mouth to pop open. Of course, over time, it just is now a habit that the mouth pops open because you get greater breath. We do not filter or humidify air through the mouth. It's only through the nose that we filter and humidify air. So some patients will say, man, mouth's dry, or I'm dry. I'm kind of feel like I'm dehydrated. I got to get up and drink water in the middle of the night. Insufficient nasal flow could be the culprit of that. The next thing, the pulse rate spikes, I'll talk about the side breaths. So these side breaths are when the body is trying to correct an airway problem. We'll gasp. We'll see airflow and we'll see airflow and the airflow just start do this. And the body says enough and you gasp. And then everything normalizes. So depending on the body's response to the airflow limitation, we may depend, that'll be how high that or how big that gasp is to kind of normalize everything. If the volume is being reduced minimally and it's a nuisance, we won't see a big side breath, but we still see correction or the attempt to correct the breathing. If the airflow volume really is reduced, then we'll see a bigger gasp to normalize everything. And there's things that we don't talk about respiratory wise in sleep. With a balance of breathing and carbon dioxide and things like that. And I only say that because after a side breath, there's always potential for a central apnea, which is a normal process of the body. We exhale too much carbon dioxide, the body will not breathe, the respiratory center will not allow the body to breathe until carbon dioxide levels rise up again to trigger another breath in a normal body system. So if you have a sleep study, and it says you have like 10 central apneas, but you got like 500 apneas or something like that. Of course you do. I'm surprised you don't have more central apneas, because after your body does a side breath or a gasp to normalize the breathing, you have blown off a tremendous amount of carbon dioxide and you're going to have a central apnea. And then you're going to start breathing again and it's going to happen again and breathing again and happen again. So essentially, if you eliminate the upper air resistance or significant respiratory events, you'll eliminate those central apneas. This is huge in kids. Before 9 months old or up to 9 months, the respiratory center is kind of as immature. So you may see just random central apneas. But after 9 months, unless there's been some sort of brain trauma, something going on with the heart or the kidneys or the gut, typically the central apneas that we're going to see on a child are post-arousal or post-side breath central apneas. I'm going to say something real quick that I get upset about. End-tidal CO2 monitoring is the gold standard for a pediatric home sleep test. But I just had 3 second opinions last week where the end-tidal CO2 was not accurate. And it was reported in the documentation. This happens all the time. The techs don't want to do it because they may have to clean out a water trap. They put it in. It doesn't work. They do the transcutaneous. It keeps coming off. They put tape on it. It doesn't pick up right. They always have to be recalibrated. So the idea of monitoring end-tidal CO2 is great, but it is not very efficient. It doesn't always work. And so they'll end up just taking it off, or you'll just have some random high CO2 all night long, and you can't say anything about it. One thing that you can, if the end-tidal CO2 does work, what's not being used is low CO2s. Of course, they're looking for retained carbon dioxide, as you can't exhale because of, in kids, enlarged adenoids or tonsils. But if a patient is continuously side breathing throughout the night, we're going to have some consistently low numbers, CO2 numbers. So when looking at an end-tidal CO2 report, we want to look at highs and lows. Also, if we're having a bunch of arousals, I'm going to believe that there's going to be some central apneas on a sleep test, especially if those responses are, or arousals are in response to the breathing. So that's my thing on that. So,
it's helpful because, you know, I feel like half the time the conversation is like, do we even send the kid for a sleep study? We know that their sleep is their sleep is messed up. They have something like, so why not? You know, so it's more of a conversation of, well, we can't even get them in for a sleep study, or there's people who won't do pediatric sleep studies. And so I guess my question is, are then home sleep tests, it sounds like you're doing them. What age, at what age can a child do a home sleep test?
The youngest I will go now is two. I've
Okay.
done 9 or 10 months early on. The youngest I'll go is two. And the case study that was done in response to home sleep testing on kids, I think it was about 350 kids or something like that. They did 4 hours was their cut max cutoff or minimum cutoff for running time for kids. So if we are looking for an airflow problem, we have the perfect airflow apparatus in the nasal cannula. That's where it's coming from. We can see the dynamics. We can see two missed breaths is an apnea for a kid. They base everything off two breaths or more. So we can see those things. You know, end-tidal CO2, if it works, is like the cherry on top. To kind of give you an idea, even though there's physicians that want to fight me and I'm going to fly out to Texas and get one, but insurance payers have been reimbursing for the home sleep test. There was a patient in Virginia who reached out to me and said that they actually were glad because you're the only provider that does it. And so, of course, they'll happily reimburse the charge versus an in-lab. It's going to be $5,000 or $6,000. When I first started, I didn't have a physician to sign off on my pediatric studies, but Medicare approved a patient for surgery with an ENT based off of the results of the test.
Wow.
Now I do have one sign off on it, but it just gives you an idea of the dynamic. And, you know, if we have to do, we have to do what we have to do to get the help we need.
Yes. Well, and you said something super key there too, which is true in like my practice because of our specialty. When you're trying to get insurance reimbursement, if there is not a provider in your location or like nearby within, sometimes they say 100 miles, which is crazy. But within so many miles around you that can offer the same service you're offering, which we know most people don't offer home sleep tests for children, period, you know, then insurance should cover it. And your fee is not expensive compared to what a lot of the fees are out there. So, you know, I would think, like you said, insurance would be happy to pay your fee versus a in-lab study, especially when that in-lab study doesn't show anything or fails, and then you got to go back and do it again, and they're billing insurance
Yes.
a second time. So yeah, I think that's a great little tidbit, but I wanted to highlight that because I'm like, that could have been a little bit buried for anybody who's not paying attention. Like if you cannot find a provider who does this in your area, which again, I don't really think there are many that do, period, then you can probably submit, you know, from Ken, the bill on your own and see if your
Yes.
insurance will reimburse you, which is great. The only downfall I feel like is usually you have to do the study first, right? And submit the invoice. It's, they're not going to they don't typically pre-approve
Yeah.
this kind of stuff, but maybe they would. I don't know.
They might, you know,
maybe
I'm going to say you
script
never
or
know.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah. If you, the likelihood of, excuse me, the likelihood of reimbursement is very high if you have a physician order. So if a physician orders a sleep test, when you submit your bill and you say, who's the referring physician? It can't be me because I'm not in network.
Right. Right.
You can, whoever your medical provider is, it'll be them. And it's been successful. Initially I was surprised because of all the pushback and kind of how medical providers look at home sleep testing for kids. Is a certain way, but insurance doesn't care. You know,
yeah.
It's a path of least resistance for them. So
yep.
it's a win
get,
for
right?
us. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I love that for you.
Yeah.
Love
yeah.
that.
So the next thing on here will be, after I talk about the Cybrefs, the SpO2 pleth. The reason I comment on the SpO2 pleth is because this tells me how significant an airflow limitation is. If there's airflow limitation and the pleth is stable, the amplitude of the pleth or the height of the amount of the heartbeat is stable, the airflow limitation, there's nothing I can say about it because the body's not responding. Physiologically, there's no change. If there's airflow limitation and the pleth starts to minimize, then I'm going to say that's important because as the pleth minimizes, now the physiology is changing. The pulse rate is going to increase and decrease based off of the amount of blood flow going to the periphery. So what we'll typically see is you have an airflow limitation, you'll have a pleth decrease, you'll see the heart rate drop, and then you'll see it spike in response to the gasp or sigh breath, the body saying, hey, we're starving, we need more. So the pleptomy is important. And also, if a patient is having some sort of cardiac issue, if there's some sort of, if there's something funky about the pleth wave, that means there's something funky with the heart rhythm. So I can pick up potential, and I try not to classify it because I don't ever want to do that. But if there's a spike or a gap in that pleth waveform, there can be PVCs, PACs, there can be pauses, there can be things going on in the EKG that would otherwise be unknown. Well, why is that important on the sleep study, especially at night? Because cardiac function during the day is not cardiac function at night. During the day, you have all your faculties. Everything is sound, muscle tone is sound. Your body knows if you're holding your breath because it's like, you're awake. You're not gonna trick me. You know, it's all these things are going on. But at night, you're in a dead state. And in a dead state, when everything is supposed to be subdued, you're not metabolizing, you're not moving or working or anything like that, the body should have no trouble. And you can see in the pleth, because we don't have EKG, you can see in the pleth if there's a problem. This was really important with a patient who was on BiPAP a long time ago. He didn't want to wear it. He thought he was a cool grandpa. And he's like, yeah, I went to the heart doctor. They ran a stress test. Stress test was fine. I'm like, but you take baby aspirin. Why is that? And he's like, oh, they just told me to take it. And you also take some statin. Like, you're taking some stuff in addition to the baby aspirin that makes me think that they're trying to normalize something going on with your heart. I run a sleep study, baseline sleep study on him. And I do not know how this man did not have a heart attack in the lab. His EKG was an abomination. Like, it just, it was terrible. You put BiPAP on him and it clears right up. That heart function did not even show during a stress test during the day. So nighttime is very important that we have as many things as we can have to look at the physiological changes. So that's why I love the pleth, the FBO2 pleth. The next thing I talk about is sometimes I'll do airflow dynamics first, and sometimes I'll talk about the severity, where things are severe. So that upper airway resistance was slightly prevalent during the REM intervals, as we saw, because we saw those pulse rate spikes, which are associated with that upper airway resistance. So airflow dynamics rarely revealed increased oropharyngeal resistance. This is important because it can give an idea, or usually when I get a sleep test, the provider knows what's going on and they just want proof. Sometimes you have a patient that doesn't believe it. Sometimes you have a parent that doesn't believe it, and you need proof to say these are things going on. And so the dynamics of the airflow, the shape of the airflow, can give us an idea of where restriction is. It can also give us an idea of how often that restriction occurs. So we all inherently have some slight airway resistance. And so it is when we start to have more intense or plateaued airflow dynamics that this kind of comes into play. So quantifying this airway resistance is difficult. So I'll say severe, moderate, mild, or rare. When I say rarely, it doesn't mean like once or twice. It just is not mild or moderate. It's a very odd way to kind of classify this, but at the same time, it could be a lot worse than what shows up. And in response to, being that this was a follow-up study, in response to the previous study, the instances of the resistance were less occurring. So the airflow dynamics, if I see constant or consistent just plateau, so if it'll be like a chair, if there's a chair, I know there's oropharyngeal resistance. And the airway has to pop open to get the rest of that breath in. Some patients, what will happen is it never pops open. It'll be flat, almost like a mountain or a tabletop. And in those instances, the tongue is just in the airway. It's not moving, no matter how big the breath is or things like that. And that typically is a huge problem. So in those instances, even if I say it's rare, if you were to have a significant plateau like that in your airflow, then either the mouth is open, you have a pretty good tongue tie, or your tone just is not where it should be. And so we have to take all that into consideration. If airflow dynamics reveal any kind of increased resistance. Baseline pulse rate, I'll talk about that. So in an area where nothing is going on, and the breathing looks pretty decent, I'm going to grab a 3 beat per minute kind of section as the baseline. And I use that 3 beat per minute section or window based off of the case study that was done with the arousals and the pulse rate. So I try not to do this in deep sleep because blood pressure and pulse are different in deep sleep. Our blood pressure should be the lowest of the night during deep sleep. We'll have a dip. If you don't have a dip or you don't have deep sleep, then you're probably going to get high blood pressure if you don't already have it. And it'd probably be idiopathic. And I try not to get it in deep sleep. I try to get in the area of light sleep where everything is just kind of cool. Nothing's really going on. And then I'll compare that to the baseline that the machine picked up. In the baseline that the machine picked up, there's going to be everything. So it could be a body movement. You know, it picks that up. It could be respiratory events, and it could be just regular activity going on. Sometimes what we'll see when a patient moves into a different body position, the pulse rate will just continually go up because they may struggle with nasal clearance on one side or the other. Also, tongue placement on one side or the other may be different. So this kind of can highlight or detail if there's really some significance in what's going on with the pulse rate. The highest pulse rate, I usually wipe that out and I go through the study and I try to get the highest pulse rate that I see with some sort of respiratory event. So if the highest is 73 and we have that occurring multiple times, we see that even at the baseline of 55.3, the range that I said the baseline was 52 to 55, I mean, we still have room for improvement if you take in consideration that the low was 52. And that's not one time. You know, it's 52 kind of scattered throughout there. So through all these things we said, we still see that there is something going on. The next line, thank you, I have a disclaimer there. The difference between the two, the baseline that the machine is picking up, it could be, it's with everything. The baseline I'm picking up is where you would be. Just if you had good, solid sleep, it would be there. In the instance that a patient has a baseline that the machine picks up that kind of coincides with the baseline I'm looking at, I would say the baseline is the same. But if not, then there's something going on that causes that true baseline or perceived baseline to be lower than that baseline that the machine is picking up.
Yeah. I mean, another thing I can share too is a couple years ago, I was closer to being done with my expansion, right? So I had used a expansion appliance at night and that was in for 2 years. And then I did about a year of Invisalign and I learned towards the end of that Invisalign, which I think was October, 2021. So not too long, maybe what was that 4 or 5, 6 months before we did. So I had April, 2022 was the surgery. And we did this either in early April or March. Yep. Okay. Yeah. March. So from October to March, basically, I learned that I retracted some of my expansion with the last couple trays of Invisalign. And I learned that while I was presenting with some airway dentists South Florida. And I was like, you guys couldn't have told me this like 2 weeks ago before I used those trays. I stopped wearing the Invisalign trays because I was like, well, if I retracted myself and the trays I'm supposed to continue wearing to maintain have put me into retraction, I don't want to wear those retainers, right? So kind of knowing that I was probably going to go into some other type of expansion, but I decided to have the nose surgery first. Now my latest conversation is trying to figure out like what my next step is because I still have my mandible my maxilla on the left side is turned a little bit inward. When you watch me speak, my jaw looks a little unstable because it almost looks like I have a crossbite. But when I'm talking, and what's happening is we actually looked at it and we were like, well, my mandible is not off midline. It's the way that my maxilla sits and now how things are kind of gliding. My tongue has now started to push and shift teeth, both upper and lower. So I know at rest, my tongue is not sitting where it needs to be in the palate because we know it's not from swallowing. I'm not sitting here like thrusting my tongue forward when swallowing or speaking. What's happening, I'm sure, is my tongue at rest at night when I'm not cognizant. Because during the day, I put it up where it needs to be, right? Like yeah. I do this, right? This is basically ingrained into my brain. So I know where it's supposed to be. So whenever I check, I'm like, yeah, lips are closed, tongue is up, teeth are slightly apart. All the things are right from a myo perspective in terms of, you know, my awareness of where my tongue should be at rest. But I know it's got to be at night that my mouth is falling open. My tongue is probably pushing. And I have a scalloped tongue when I wake up. So I can see, right, that, yeah. So anyways, I think that with a little bit of that retraction, I think I made that space a little bit smaller than what it should have been. And I've now, I had a conversation with a airway focused orthodontist who is now practicing in Boca. And so I'm really excited because they're 10 minutes away from me. However, she said that because of the nasal surgery, depending on what was done, and I have to talk to the ENT, the rhinoplasty, I may not be a candidate for MARPI. So I'm going, no, I wanted to see if I could split the suture line, right? And fix the maxilla. I think that would actually have really great improvements for what we're still seeing as far as, you know, the airway goes. But either way, I feel like there is some form of expansion in my future again, at least upper expansion. And then we'll see, you know, what happens with the lower, you know, what the recommendation is there. But with the oral appliance, I know that, you know, looking at your recommendations, I was kind of like, yep, okay, this is kind of in the back of my mind. And I'm like, I really don't want to have to wear anything to sleep at night. So if we can go for more expansion, whatever that looks like I'm here for it.
I will say I used to recommend this. I talked to a dentist about this a long time ago. Just stability. If you can just keep the mandible stable at night, that would improve, you know, because if you don't, I mean, it gets wild, you know, but if you can, you don't necessarily have to pull out, you know, you can just, as long as it's stable, you kind of have a hold on the tongue. You kind of have a leash on it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where I figure, well, we have to go figure out what my options are. And I figure that she will, you know, I'm like, if nothing else, I need something at night to support my jaw, like you said, when I'm sleeping. Yeah. But it's so interesting too, because as I watch myself in videos, like I had a video post from a podcast episode on YouTube or a little clip on Instagram actually this morning, and I'm watching my own jaw and I'm like, wow, that looks awful. Like I just see I'm like, it looks like my lower jaw is just sliding all over the place. And I don't have any jaw pain. I don't have any, you know, I think visible issues outside of the fact that my teeth just look like they don't go together when I'm speaking. And so I was like sitting in front of the mirror before we recorded, and I was like doing some exercises that Autumn, actually I did a consult with her a couple years ago, and I was like, Autumn, look, my maxilla turns inward and it didn't get fixed with expansion. I'm gonna go have my nose done, but like give me what would you do? And so I did a consult with her, and she, you know, professional. Nice. She was like, here's some things, you know, you can try. And so I was like, yeah, let me go back to some of those things. And so I was just trying to sit there and control the mandible up and down and just see if I can, you know, because it when I open, if you watch, it goes off midline. And I think that's really more so related to the maxilla is not midline. So if you see where my finger sits here under my nose, we've realized that my mandible does sit midline, but my maxilla is not midline. So now it's impacting the TMJ on my left side. So I'm like, I also feel like if I don't address it, it's only going to get worse. So you know, we're kind of at this impasse where I'm like, I can make an active choice not to do something, or back into another round of expansion I go. Just a debate as to what that expansion is going to look like. So so that's where I'm at. So I'll keep you posted, because, you know, another couple years from now, we might be in for another one of these.
I definitely would be interested to see. One thing that I will say is I love doing comparison studies, because I learned so much through the whole thing. It would be mouth taping, asterisk, oral appliance, or things before and after or during, because it's really interesting on patient signs and symptoms versus the therapy versus without anything. And sometimes sometimes without anything looks better. Sometimes with tape and oral appliances, physiologically will look better, but the breathing will not look better.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting kind of doodad.
Yeah. I mean, I'd be so curious to see studies, you know, done with the lip tape and without the lip tape, with the appliance and without the appliance, because I feel like there are certain patients where there's other things going on, like you're saying, and it may not always look like there's improvement. And I've had all these conversations with Autumn, and actually just had MyoSpot on the podcast too. And
yeah,
we, you know, I like that tape. I'm not a big proponent about taping in general, unless we know that the airway is safe to tape, which is kind of a funny thing to even say, because this is an airway that's obviously not healthy probably for having to tape. But I love that their tape allows you to breathe through the tape if you have to. And it probably will also pop off if you absolutely need to. And my whole thing about like taping with like kids, we kind of dove into that. And I feel like, you know, with kids, that's the scarier thing. Obviously, parents can make whatever decision they want to, but there's a lot of myotherapists out there who just say, tape everybody. And I'm going, hold up, wait a second. Like that can be really dangerous if we don't understand what we're doing here. And if you're now taking away the fact that this child needs to mouth breathe, you know, and you've taped across their lips with a tape that they can't get off. Like you basically masking tape their mouth shut, like hard stop. You know, right. Yeah. I mean, and you see, I see these videos go out sometimes of these kids with tape all the way across their entire mouth versus like up and down. And it's not porous tape. It's, you know, it's like, you might as well, like I said, take masking tape and just shut that kid's mouth. And I'm like, no, never. I don't think we should ever be doing that.
Yeah.
Personally, but you know, here we are.
I know it's and a lot of patients ask, and every time I'm like, I always say mild tape, because you do have an escape, or if you want to do kinesiology tape just here, like one down, one up,
around,
and have this free, you know, because when you do need to. Yeah. Get it out. Obviously the nose is compromised.
Right.
And, you know, if you do need to pop open it for volume or something like that, it needs to be there, because otherwise the tongue will just close right on off the airway.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, and as you've pointed out, then we're causing stress to the heart, and we're basically putting this body into fight or flight all night. And all you're doing is wreaking havoc on when you're trying to help, right? The goal is we're trying to help this kid. But in turn, what I think most people don't realize is, if it's not appropriate for that kid or adult, you know, you can be doing more harm than good. And so I think it matters what you're using. Like you said, how you're taping. Are you using kinesio tape and just taping and, you know, around the mouth or just over the edges so that we can breathe through our mouth if we absolutely need to? You know, that's where I think there needs to be more conversation. And I don't see enough of that happening where we're talking about how we're taping and where the tape goes and what kind of tape we're using. So hopefully someone will listen to this if, you know, they're putting masking tape across their kids' mouth for their own. And
I love
like,
everybody.
Uh-oh.
Don't come for me with the.
You can come at me. That's fine. Don't go
I've
after Ken.
So many, I've had so many conversations about tape, and I'm like, I mean, I don't. If somebody asks me, I don't necessarily like it unless I know the nose is fit. Unless, you know, I know. But if someone has chin recession and you're taping, that could be a little tough. And I'm saying it out of love. I'm saying it out of love, you know. Want the airway to be pain. If there's nasal insufficiency, that may be tough. That may be why there is mouth breathing. If there is chin recession, if the maxilla is reduced, you know, it may be a little bit tougher for getting the desired result, which would be nasal breathing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the thing also that Dr. Shihab said when we were recording was it's also not like the end game. Like if you're using the tape and it, you know, we're using a porous tape and we're going from top to bottom. And he even like talked about cutting the tape for like, you know, smaller lips and everything. So that it's really just going lip to lip, not even over and above sometimes. And, you know, it's like, oh, this seems like a much safer option. It's not the end game. Like we don't want to be taping for life, which is the other conversation I see happening a lot is almost as if we're taping, you know, for life to have a good night's sleep every night. And I'm thinking, how did we get here? You know, his whole thing was, it's almost like, I always joke, I'm like the worst person when it comes to promoting my certification. Cause I'm like, I tell everybody you don't need to be certified in Mayo if you have the right licensure to do it. I'm like, hey, here I am, like, you know, and he's kind of going like, look, this is like not the end all be all. Like, you don't want to tape for life. Meanwhile, he sells the product, right? So yeah. I'm like, yeah. When you have somebody who's saying things like this and they're selling the product, like, maybe we should listen to them.
Yes.
I'm just saying. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. I do feel like we have those interims, like figure out what's going on, figure out if you can, if it's within your means to fix and cure, you know, correct. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, this has been amazing, Ken. Thank you again so much. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to wrap up with?
No, don't y'all make fun of me for my sunroom.
I love it. Love it. It's awesome. Okay, so tell them where they can find you.
TrueSleepDiagnostics.com is the website. TrueSleepSC@gmail.com is email. I am going to sometime soon add a patient tab or a tab for patients to go to see what the process is. And I'll do my own tutorial. Because some things are a little bit different than the one on the site, but everything is there. Order forms or request forms are there. Payment links are there. If you have questions, it's a lot quicker or easier to email me than it is to call me, because I do still have a full-time job for my health insurance and because I spend money really crazy. So email me and I usually will get back to you pretty quick, which I'll check like at the end of the day every day.
But email him because, you know, you're like me. Getting a phone call back is like our least favorite thing to do.
Probably. Man, yeah. I will talk to you all day on the email.
There you go. I love it. Well, thank you, Ken. This has been so amazing. I appreciate you reviewing and kind of like side by side comparing the before and after sleep study. And, you know, like I said, we're going to go for another round of expansion at this point. So I don't know what it's going to be. So stay tuned for that. But once we get into that or further into that or complete that, we'll do a third study to kind of circle back up.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. If you found value in this episode and want to hear more of these MyoTOTS airway and feeding related episodes, be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode on your social media platforms. You can access free resources and all I offer at HallieBalkin.com or pop over to @HallieBalkin on Instagram to get all the latest updates.